overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week. Many blessings to you.
This is how the Sufis applaud, so you don't break the vibrational field of that beautiful prayer that was sung through those beautiful lyrics. You know, that song is very, very dear to my heart, because one of the things that I do in my ministry is I liberate the soul through dance. And you know, this being human, life is a zigzag path, as Emerson says. You don't go directly to your vocation. And initially, I was a dancer, I was an actor, and then I was a landscaper. And then at age 40, I ended up as a minister. This was the only profession that I said I would never, ever do. I wouldn't go into a church. I considered it the opiate of the people. And look, it's been 30 years that I've been here at the center. But when I was a dancer, I realized that I wasn't there to be on Broadway as a Baryshnikov, that I was always, in everything I did, I was liberating the soul. And so when I would do my dance with the beloved, and today I'm speaking about the beloved, these dance workshops were to create a level of intimacy with ourselves and this invisible something we can call the beloved, God, spirit, whatever you want to call it. And so one of the most difficult things that I would do in this dance experience was to break the room into two halves. I called them the butterflies and the flowers. And I invited all the flowers to come and stand in the center of the circle, and they were there to close their eyes and to put their hands down by their sides. None of this hiding. You have to, in a gesture of receptivity. And then I told all the butterflies that they had to go and pollinate every flower that they could in the time that they had. And Karen Drucker would be singing that song, "You are the heart, you are the hands of spirit on earth." And I told the flowers that they needed to receive the love. And you know, that's one of the hardest things for us to do. It's easy to give the love, but to just stand there and to receive it with your eyes closed from a total stranger, stroking your face, putting their arms around you. I can remember every time that I would have to be a flower, I would be sobbing because I wasn't used to receiving love. And so I knew if it was hard for me, it was going to be hard for the flowers. And it was. There was a woman in England said, "I felt the love of God for the first time with a total stranger, with a total stranger's arms around me." That's how powerful it is to open to receive the love. And then after the flowers had been all loved up by the butterflies, I said, there is a spiritual practice in the Inca tradition. It's called sacred reciprocity, and basically says, if you have received, then you must give back. So I said, now all you butterflies get to be flowers, and all you flowers get to be butterflies, and you get to experience the beautiful art of receiving the love. Receiving the love. Yeah, a simple little practice, a simple little exercise, but what if that's what all of this is all about? It's just about receiving the love that's everywhere present, and it's always pouring itself into us. The beautiful revealing service this morning was very powerful, because as one of the souls was talking about the dark night of their soul as the breakthrough for this awakening, none of us knows how the beloved is going to break through. Some of us need that universal slap. I went like this. Oh, I needed that. That felt so good. You know, this thing that wakes you up. When I first came to this teaching, and I was 30 years old, I was going through midlife crisis, and everything was going to hell in a handbasket. And I remember I would come and hear this man speak every Sunday, and I finally came to realize, and Anastasia will appreciate this, that I was the only problem that I had. I had this belief about everybody that they were the problem, and I was the problem. And so finally, when I got that together, I thought, oh my God, it's me by my projection onto others that was the problem all along. And so then I went to all my friends and says, you know, you're the problem in your life. You're the problem in your life. You're the problem. And I lost all my friends. And I thought, wow, this isn't really going to work, is it? So then I learned to keep my little mouth shut and just do the work on my own transformation. I had to evolve and grow. I had to evolve, and we are here to evolve and grow into what I refer to as Homo Universalis. I'm doing this month's series on a little book called Emergence by Barbara Marx Hubbard, who is one of my heroes. She made her transition this year at age 89. She called herself a futurist and a scientist and a spiritual lady. The very first book she wrote was a retranslation of the New Testament because she wanted to make it clear what Jesus was really saying. And Jesus said, when he said, "Our Father, which art in heaven," he was referring to the beloved that was within himself, not about some power outside him. Think about how that changes everything. Our beloved, which is within us, hallowed be thy name. Wholeness is thy nature. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done in my life, as it is in this consciousness that we call heaven, this inner place of splendor. So you realize that the Lord's Prayer and what Jesus was talking about was to seek the kingdom of heaven, which is this beloved that's within all of us, and that was his only message. He never talked about burning in hell. He never condemned anybody. And he would say things like, "What I do, you too shall do, and greater than me." Right? He would say, "If you've seen me, you've seen the beloved. You've seen the Father." He'd say, "I myself do nothing. It's this beloved within that does everything." He was pointing the way, and she says, we have to experience the Christification of humanity. Now, the Christ was not Jesus' last name. It was a state of consciousness that he had acquired. You could call it the Buddha consciousness. And so, Barbara Marx Hubbard said, there have been what they call evolutionary throw forwards on this planet for decades. Plato and Emerson and Walt Whitman and Barbara Marx Hubbard and Parker Palmer and Ajahshanti, evolutionary throw forwards that are saying, you are nothing, and yet you are everything. Nisargadatta, when I knew that I was nothing, no thing, that's when wisdom awoke in me. And when I knew that I was everything and everyone, that's when love awoke in me. Ah, so it's the wave knowing that it's the ocean, finally. It's not a wave that's separate, but it's the ocean as the wave. Well, that's the invitation for all of us, is to know our true nature as this beloved essence self. Let me give you just a tiny taste of Barbara's words. She said, essence is like, now the subtitle of the book is Moving from Ego to Essence. Now, I love this little thing called the ego. Seamus had a beautiful revealing thing in the revealing service about when they praise the ego likes it, but that's as big a trap as being judged. And I learned early on in ministry, the ones that condemn you are the first ones that'll praise you, and what other people think of me is none of my business, and then I'm free to be the crazy, wild expression of who I am, and it doesn't matter. The praise and the condemnation has nothing to do with me. It has everything to do with someone else. The ego wants the praise. The ego gets its buttons pushed, but essence doesn't. And you know you're really evolving when you don't get your buttons pushed anymore, or even better, when they get pushed, you say, "Thank you, you pushed my buttons." I think it was Lee that said he called his sister and had been estranged for years. I haven't spoken to my twin sister in, I think, almost a year now. She's one of those kind of people that kind of drives me crazy, but I know I need to do it, because even as crazy as she is my twin sister. So thank you for giving me a little bit of egoic guilt in my otherwise perfect existence. He said, essence is like a wonderful spring of living waters. That's our true nature, essence. And it fills up daily and wants to be expressed. You know, this is the heart of the universe. These are the hands of God. This is the voice of the universe speaking. He's that, the Karen Drucker song. That's the essence that we all are. And it wants to express. If it is not expressed, she says, it will signal us by depression, disease, and addictions. The word wants to come forth. The inner voice wants to be heard, and now is the hour of our emergence. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was made manifest. This is the Word of Spirit speaking through each one of us. And if it doesn't find an outlet through us, well, then it kind of shrivels in on itself, because there's this tendency to think we're the doer, and really we're not the doer. Spirit is the doer. And when we get out of the way, then it can have its way with us. And it requires absolute surrender to that. So one of my heroes is Ralph Waldo Emerson, another evolutionary throw forward, or what Barbara Marx Hubbard calls a Hebe, a highly evolved being. And Ralph Waldo Emerson, he said, we misrepresent ourselves. We think we're that counting, logical, thinking man. And he says, to him, we do not give a flying whatever. But to the soul, he said, when it speaks through us, it makes us stand in awe. And when the soul loves through us, we feel the love of the universe. Could we move into that higher order of being? And in order to do that, Emerson said, here's the formula. It's very simple. He says, be and not seem. Be the beloved that you are and not the egoic personality that you seem to be. Be and not seem. He says, then let us acquiesce. Let us surrender to that which is already there. Get our bloated nothingness out of the way. Does anybody understand bloated nothingness? You get that out of the way, and then you connect with the divine circuits. So he's given us a very simple formula, just to be who you are. And to get the me out of the way, the me that thinks there is somebody that's really special. So Ram Dass has a very sweet way of talking about this evolutionary process. He says, you're born as a nobody, and then you go into somebody training. And you spend so much of your life as the somebody that you think will be acceptable to the world and accrue all the success and the fame and the fortune until you realize that that somebody is really the obstacle to knowing your true nature, which is nobody. So then you go back into nobody training. It's a beautiful evolutionary spiral that we get to go through on this life. Just a little tiny bit more of Barbara. So he says, as newly emerging universal humans, we begin to feel more at home within ourselves, making a conscious choice to come in the whole way as to who we are. We were talking about trust, Kim and I, this morning. We trust that I don't have to have the expectation, because if David has an expectation, he's always going to be disappointed. You know, I expected you all to be there at the picnic. What was wrong with you? You know, you don't have expectations. We were expecting to go up there, and I would move into the beautiful picnic grounds. Trey and I go up there every day. We walk the dogs. Huge picnic grounds. We go up to the place. We're pulling in, and all of a sudden, they're having a car show and a race. And they stopped us at the gate and said, you can't come in. I says, what do you mean? We're having the church picnic. We're having a car show today. Well, nobody told me about the car show. And so then Raul, in this beautiful thing, he's at the office, and he tries to find us a pavilion, and we head on into the trailers. And I'm realizing that pavilion's full, so I turn around, go back up to the front desk, no expectations. I go in, and I said, my family's having a picnic, and we're getting together, and we haven't seen each other in a long time. It's just a little artistic lie. And she said, well, you just move on to the pavilion over there, and you have a nice time with your family. What are they bringing? I said, I don't know, but I know it'll be wonderful. So my spiritual family qualifies for family, no expectations, trusting in the universe will provide, and it was even better, wasn't it, Jane, than what we could have imagined. We were sheltered from the storm. So Barbara Marx Hubbard, she talks about having an inner love affair with this true nature that you are, to love the beloved in you. It's the one that's fun. It's the one that doesn't react. It's the one that rolls with the punches and says, you know, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. That's the beloved. She said, have a love affair with your true nature, not with your ego that's always filled up with reaction and expectations. The three things that will get you into really egoic trouble are expectations, attachment, and resistance. That's the pathway to suffering. Let those who have ears to hear, E-A-R. Anyway, she said, there was a joy in my homecoming, and she said, I was becoming the mother to myself and losing the orphaned feeling that I had since my mother died. Her mother died when she was a young woman. She herself was a mother of five children. But as I discovered this year at Sunrise Ranch, and I really discovered it right after the heart attack, that I had abandoned my own little boy. And I had to be the one that nurtured and loved him. It wasn't about all y'all nurturing me. That's great. I had to be the one that would take that little boy who didn't feel that he was enough, that was shamed, and when he would withdraw and flee from the world, because that was his MO, to escape and withdraw into himself and find a tree or a rock to hug, I had to tell that little boy that he was okay. Anybody see the movie Rocket Man? It's the story of Elton John, and it's the same idea. Elton John did not receive the love from his parents. It led to a path of addiction, and he was addicted to everything. And he hit the wall, he hit rock bottom, and then he came back, and in his montage, and it's beautifully done, you see his own little boy coming, not to receive the love of his mother or his father, but to receive Elton's love. And so she's having the same experience. My abandoned, orphaned little girl had to be received by me. So one of the final steps for all of us is to love that exiled part of ourselves. If we want to be whole, we can't just be erudite, smart, and clever. We also have to take that wounded little part of ourselves, that little frightened wonder child, and give them space to just be who they are, because we're all connected. You know, when Terry's little daughter, Dominique, stayed at the house, we had these little wrens. They're the house wren, and Trey tells me the house wren is very rare in the South. They're a northern bird, but for some reason they chose to nest in our little birdhouse on the side of the house. And so Dominique sent photographs of the little birds as they were peeking out of the birdhouse, two little beeps. And well, so when we came back from the mountains, they were getting big. And I noticed that the birdhouse is in full sun for half of the day. And by 11, 12 o'clock, their beaks were going. And so initially I was codependent, and I went and hung the bird feeder next to the birdhouse thinking that the parents could feed the birds from the bird feeder. And Trey said, "You're inviting all the other birds to attack the parents." I went, "Oh." So I moved the bird feeder and I put it back where the other bird feeders are. And I thought, the parents know what they're doing. I'm just going to back away. But then when the heat came, I took an umbrella, and I'm standing out there all day holding the umbrella over the. And I'm thinking, I think they got another 3 or 4 days till they do their thing. Well, that afternoon, I went out there to see if they were okay, and they were gone. And I thought, oh, God. I said, "Trey, the little babies are gone." He says, "They're dead." I said, "Well, that's not a good thought." And I went and I looked under the flower beds. They weren't in the flower beds. And the next thing I heard, that they were in the backyard on the stone wall. And they were beeping, beeping, and Mom and Dad were coming down to feed them. And I said, "They're in the backyard." And then I came and I taught a class here, and I came home from class, and guess what? One of them was in the garage. Last year, the wrens nested in the garage and they all died, because you know how hot garages can be. So I'm going through the garage looking for that little baby bird. And remember, they're all your children. It's not just the two-leggeds. Well, I guess birds have two legs too. But it's even the little ones. So I found the baby bird, and it was in the Coleman cooler, the same one that I brought up to the mountain yesterday. I hope I washed it out. Anyway, it just had bottles of water in there. Anyway, the baby bird was in the Coleman cooler, and I carried it out, and I yelled upstairs to Trey, "Trey, it's in the Coleman cooler." And he says, "Put it on its side." So I put it on its side, and I said, "Come on out, honey, come on out." And about 2 hours later, it came out of the Coleman cooler, and the next thing I know, it's in the Vitex tree in Mall. But they're all our children, and we're all connected. And it's not that there's a hierarchy, that there's a more or a less. They're all our children, even the smallest of these. So she goes on to say, to be the mother. When I was in South Africa, this beautiful woman spoke, and she said she had 5 children. They all died from AIDS. And she said this most amazing thing. She said, "We are all the mother. These just weren't my children, and they are all our children." And in that moment, whether it's a wren, whether it's a child with AIDS in Africa, they're all our children. And you get to that realization after a while. So one of the things Barbara Marx Hubbard does in this little book of instruction is she goes within and she listens to what Emerson called the Orphic voice, the voice of the beloved within her. And then she has this practice of getting her journal out. Artists get their paints out, and you allow that something to express. When I first met Seamus, poetry would pour through him, and it was his soul that would pour the poetry through, and had all the emotions that he doesn't normally show emotion, but boy, could you feel it in the poetry. That's the beauty of using journaling. So here's what this is what the beloved said to her in her journal. The beloved said, "You have put this purpose first." Her purpose was to awaken the noosphere in humanity. You know, and she was very determined. She called it tele-erotic, to have this purpose and to be so deeply entrenched in your purpose that you're in love with your purpose. So the beloved in her says, "You have put this purpose first. You built your inner sanctuary and you placed your attention on me, the beloved. And through that attention, you, the local self, the ego self, substantiated me, the beloved." Do you get it? The more you put your attention on the still small voice, the more you put your attention on the peace that passes all understanding, the more you put your attention on the love that knows no other, that begins to take dominion in your world. It's no longer me driving the car, but you're actually listening to this thing that binds us together in that field of love. So she says, through that attention, you, the local egoic self, substantiated me, the beloved. You called me in, and this process requires that I, the beloved, be invited by the local self. This is the meaning of free will. This is the meaning of the personal conscious evolution. This is the substance of the transformation open to every human being on earth. I am now, by grace, your choice to give you the reward. So this is the beloved speaking to her. When you give yourself to me, I give myself to you. And lastly, she said, the reward is union with me, the ever-present, ever-loving, all-knowing, divine self of every human being on earth. rest your attention in me so that I can infuse you minute by minute, second by second, with the elixir of the substance that actually does transmutate and transfigure you. We're being transmutated. We're being transformed. We are the caterpillar becoming the butterfly, or the human becoming the embodied soul. And that's what each one of us is becoming. That's our destiny. That's our destination. How does that feel? You know, it requires a death and a rebirth. Terry was sharing that she had a semi-death with this dark night, but what was born was this beautiful light that was there all along. And sometimes it doesn't feel as good as we think it's going to feel, because everything that we'd identified has to fall away in order for this new life to emerge. So that's this emergent evolution that she's talking about, that Ernest Holmes talked about. He talked about involution and evolution, and about our conscious participation in that dynamic in each one of us lives. So, I know it's not for the faint of heart, is it? To be told that everything that you thought was so important really doesn't matter. But what really does matter is something that has been trying to get your attention your whole life. As a brand new minister, I met this lady named Marilyn Lundstrom, and she was a religious scientist. And she wrote a little book, and she sent it to me here at the center and endorsed it to David, and I hope you enjoy it. But it's all about oneness. And Ernest Holmes, and I'm going to read you one of his very last sermons. I'm doing this for Rocky, so you can hear. At the end of Ernest Holmes' life, he's saying the exact same thing that Barbara Marx Hubbard is saying, that we have to know our true nature as this divine presence, not as the local self. Remember Emerson, the finite self wails and suffers. Me and my story. In Terry Shea's church, they have little Velcro things on the forehead and on the wrists so people can go around. And it's the finite self that wails and suffers. He says, but that infinite presence lies stretched in smiling repose. Could we discover that thing, that self that doesn't react but that responds and realizes that when life gives you something, it's really an opportunity for growth? You know, that, like, we've had a lot of death here at the center. And the one thing I know about death is that spirit never died. So when are we going to start relating as spiritual beings? Spirit is still here. Dorothy is still here. She was one of my biggest fans and one of my biggest critics. And you know what? And I love both parts of her. And I think she had a difficult time when I started going through this transformation. I think a lot of people did. Trey really had a hard time. But like Terry, you described so beautifully, it's not pleasant to watch somebody die and give birth to this something that we all are. So here's Marilyn Lundstrom in her little definition of oneness. And the book's called Oneness. And Ernest Holmes in The Science of Mind, he says, if one, 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 Ernest Holmes said, if we teach anything, we teach oneness. So here's her take on oneness. It's a poem called One. Spirit, presence, principle, energy, beloved, way, light, universal mind, life essence, higher power, infinite possibility, God, universe, awareness, force, ground of being, self, all that is. These are all names of God, if you will. She said, God is all. One God incarnated as all people. I would say as all beings. To take the other beings out of God, we're not superior. So I would change that, as all people and as all beings. Omnipotent, that means all-powerful. Omniscient, which means all-knowing. And omnipresent, which means it's everywhere revealing itself. So she said, God is the creator, the creative process, and the created. That is the Trinity. You know, the creator creating the creation. So God is the creator, the creative process, or the Holy Spirit, and the created. And she says, the lover and the beloved are one. Now, it's very interesting. I was reading a book called The Secret of Rumi, and Rumi was big on this idea of the beloved. And they talk about the last veil that must be seen through. And you know what the last veil is? It's so interesting. There's 70,000 veils that keep us from this direct experience with the beloved. The last veil is the idea of lover and beloved. When the veil of lover and beloved as separate falls away, then all there is the love. And that's what we are. We are just the love. We're not the one that's doing the loving. We're not the creator. We're not the created. We're not the lover. We're not the loved. We're the loving. And that's all there is the loving. So he goes to say, lover and the beloved are one. The observer and the observed are one. Huh. The implicate and the explicate are one. I did that well. The highest God, meaning the transcendent God, and the innermost God, which is the immanent God, are one. The macrocosm and the microcosm are one. The visible and the invisible are one. The absolute and the relative are one. The universal consciousness and the individual consciousness are one. Man is individualized, not individual. Individualized means that he is an aspect of the one. He's the ocean is the wave. So man is individualized, not individual, expression of the one. Thou art that, I am thou. The knowing, the knower, the known are one. One known by its different names. Thus, nothing can exist outside of God. There is not God and you. There can only be God being you. You are the activity of God in manifestation, the projection of God into expression. Wow, you got to be so humble to say that, don't you? The eighth psalm, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Thou hast made him a little lower than the angels and hath crowned him with honor and glory. We are here to glory and honor this true nature that we all are. Boy, you have to be so humble to say that. I am God in action. I am the way the divine delights in itself. So, last but not least, the Ernest Holmes papers. Now, this man was prolific from the 20s until his death in 1960. But at the end of his life, he was giving a very, very different message than he did at the beginning of his life. The beginning of his life, and he's the founder of this teaching, he was teaching a mental science. And this was during the times of the Depression, when people needed to get a better idea, to have a better way of living, and at a time when people needed to have an understanding. And he came through the Christian Science tradition, which worked on spirit healing the body. So he came from that lineage. But as, just like you and I, he began to evolve. And at the very end of his life, this is the way he was speaking. He says, there is another self, not just your egoic self. He says, there is this inner self. The beloved, we might call it. Socrates called it, and he gives the name in Greek. By that, he meant his real spirit, his self with the big S. And it is the thing, the capital T, and he referred to God as the thing itself. And you know, my little Zen calendar said, it is everywhere. The thing is everywhere. Spirit is everywhere. And then yesterday, Lao Tzu said, and the entryway to this beloved is everywhere. Every moment, those little birds that we were rescuing or didn't rescue, that was an entryway. Terry going through the dark night was an entryway. Each one of us finds an entryway. So he said, it is the thing with which or in whom Jesus was in continual communication. He called this thing the Father within him. And he said, our Father which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Jesus was not praying to an external God, but to a divine inner presence, which he knew to be universal side of himself. We are all that same universal self. Wow. So the title of today's talk, and this came right out of Barbara Marks-Hubbard's book, is to give the beloved dominion over your life. Now, what would your life look like if you weren't driving the car, the life? I like what Eckhart Tolle said. He said, can you imagine your life if the no mind were in control instead of your local mind? He says there wouldn't be all those problems and expectations and projections and resistance and attachment. You would be actually free. And Barbara Marks Hubbard said that the symptoms of an evolved being is a greater level of consciousness. It's not my way or the highway. A deeper sense of freedom because you're free of the tyranny of your own thoughts and a deeper capacity to love. You can love with equanimity. Everything becomes your lover. Because you're love itself, and you're not separate from anything. So that's the symptom of someone who's consciously evolving. So Ernest Holmes, he says, this is what the great composers and artists, the creative people listen to, is that still small voice within themselves. They may not know it, they may doubt it, and it doesn't matter. That is what they listen to. That is what directs them. That is what is back of all creativity, which is the inner creator that's in us. That is why Emerson said that the mind that wrote history is the mind that must read it. Now, in his essay, History, Emerson starts off by saying, there is one mind common to all. And then he said, just here, the mind that wrote it must be the mind that reads it. So what if you're reading some really inspired words from Rumi or from Emerson? You have to, the only way I have found to really get into a dance with it is to know that it's my own self speaking. And then I hear it at that deep level where I can do what they call resonate with that. It makes sense. So Rumi, here again, this incredible mystic from the 12th century who continued to evolve throughout his life, he said there's only one rule. I love it when there's only one. He said, break the wine glass. That's your belief system. And then fall back to the breath of the wine glass blower. Wow. Is that not abstract? You fall back to the breath within the breath, to the essence that's not conditioned by form. And so each one of us goes through this evolutionary process. Now, it's funny, in reading the biography of Rumi, he was born in Balkh, Afghanistan, in 1206. And this was during the time of Genghis Khan, and his father was a very erudite Sufi master. And so he was studying from the tutelage of his father, who was 60 when Rumi was born. At age 6 or 7, they moved to Samarkand. Some of us who've traveled, and he lived in Samarkand, this beautiful Muslim city with blue-tiled walls for 6 years. And he met Ibn Arabi, one of the great Sufi mystics. But then fleeing Genghis Khan, they went to Bukhara. And in Bukhara, he met Attar, which is one of the great Sufi teachers who wrote Conference of the Birds. So here in Rumi's life, he's evolving as he meets these great teachers. And then when they finally got to Konya and they settled down, his father became the great Puba in Konya, and he wanted to pass his legacy down to his son, but his son was caught up in the letter of the law. He was caught up in Sharia law. He hadn't died into the presence yet. And in the Sufi way of teaching, they say there are 3 stages. The first is tauba, which is the turning of the heart. The heart turns toward the beloved and turns away from its egoic satisfaction. Then the second is, and Terry will appreciate this, this is fana, which is the annihilation of the local self, the part that wants to judge right or wrong. We did a beautiful satsang this Wednesday, and one of the students said, I want to move out of the consciousness that judges things as right or wrong and just be the space that can see it for what it is. That's Rumi. Out beyond the ideas of right thinking and wrong thinking, there is this field. And when the soul lies down in that field, words are not necessary. Judgments don't exist. Let's meet in that field. So he's describing that. But then finally, the last stage that of the true abiding in the beloved is a thing called tauba, where you're abiding in this divine love, in this presence. But it doesn't happen overnight. And so when Rumi was like 35, in comes this vagabond dervish named Shams of Tabriz. He was like a homeless man on a donkey. And he sees Rumi surrounded by his students. And he was famous at that stage in his 30s. And here's this vagabond, and he asks Rumi, so who is more powerful, Bayezid Bustami or Muhammad? And Rumi says, well, Muhammad, of course. Bless his soul, or whatever they say after that phrase. And he said, well, it's strange that you should say that, because Bayezid Bustami said, I am that, Al-Haq. I am the presence. Whereas Muhammad said, none of us can really know the presence, but we can only talk about it. And in that moment, Rumi, his face changed, and he realized that Bayezid Bustami, one of the great Sufis, said, we have to become the very thing. Instead of God being outside ourselves, it has to be an embodied thing. So Rumi dropped everything, and he went off with this dervish, and he went through his own transmutation and came back forever changed, and they didn't like it. They didn't like the Rumi that came back. His students wanted the old religious science teacher, not this on-fire preacher about love. So Ernest Holmes is talking about the same thing. He says, you know, the whole purpose and the whole aim of our life is discover this true nature, the beloved within ourselves. That's the purpose of life. And he goes on to say, and he said, any person who will listen long enough and deeply enough to their own divine reality within themselves will become aware of it, with a capital I, and he will gradually be directed by it. He's turned their lives over to the beloved, and he will know that he is an immortal being. I'm giving that one to Judy. He's an immortal being. We're all immortal beings, and we are on a portal to this external self-expression of the beloved revealing itself. Ernest Holmes, one of the last sermons he gave, saying we have to be the beloved in expression. It's not about manifesting a car anymore. And he says, and every man who believes that God in him is what he is, without conceit, now calls upon this divine presence and that says, be what I am. We say to this divine presence, be what I am. I don't want to be the one out in charge anymore. It's not David anymore. Let the beloved do this stuff. He said, loose yourself in it. Let it go. Open the doors of the prison of the self and free this imprisoned splendor. And whether it is selling shoes or polishing automobiles or racing horses or singing songs or writing a hymn, they're all the same thing. Let the unwise try to divide this indivisible wholeness. Don't you ever try to do it, he said. Wow. Whoever you are, whatever your purpose is in life, it's God doing it. Ernest Holmes. Got to give him credit. Lastly, he says, remember this. The universe exists for the delight of God. That means that you are here for the delight of God. Now, what that says to me is this universe wants to delight in itself. So it wants us to play and to sing and to write poetry and to paint and to be a fool for God and sometimes do the outrageous. Try to save some baby wrens along the way. Lose yourself in it. He said, why not accept this? There's no arrogance in it. Every song that was ever written was written by the one mind, slightly differentiated in its uniqueness of the individual writer. And if we could keep our minds open to that, we would have divine direction. Divine direction. Wow. And he goes on and on and on about how the more we allow this presence to reveal itself, the less attached we are to outcome, and the more we are into the sacredness of the process of living, of being. Who was it? Someone here teaches the artist's way. They've been doing it for years. Oh, yes. And we taught that here every summer at the center. And one of the things that Julia Cameron talks about, it's not about the product. It's about the very act of creative self-expression. And she says, don't put your editor in the way. Don't say that this is good or this is bad or I shouldn't have written that. And, you know, once this creative flow starts to happen, could we be that conduit through which it happens? So then you hear the poetry in a different way. You hear the metaphor in a different way. Like Hafez said, I am a hole in the flute through which the Christ plays its music. You're kind of going, huh? He is the opening through which the music of the universe comes through. Or as Mother Teresa said, I am a pencil in the hand of God. I myself am nothing. You know, this divine love is using this life, called Mother Teresa, to love. You know, and she says there are no great acts of love, only little acts done with great love. Well, and so you begin to see that it's in the littlest of things that we're really transforming the world. Every time we smile at someone, every time we call our sister, every time we put our arms around someone that might be suffering, reach out and touch somebody, you know, with a look, with a smile. I think that's what we had at the picnic yesterday. There was so much love there, and we didn't take that thing that you have no place to go. We knew that the right and perfect place would reveal itself, and it did effortlessly. There wasn't a whole lot of stress. Now, we could have gone into stress, and I think Trey wanted to go down that path. But then you just get out of the car, and you go on, and you find out there's this thing waiting right there for you. Yeah. So, let's just close our eyes and experience this beloved presence that's right there. In the Quran, they say it's as close as your jugular vein. That's pretty close. The breath within the breath. They also say in the zikr, La ilaha illallah, there's nothing but Allah, which is the beloved. There's nothing but the beloved. And so as we fall into that realization that all there is this presence, whatever we want to call it, the many names of God, the energy of love, an abiding peace. And as Dr. Ernest Holmes in that sermon at the end, he said, until our life becomes the embodiment of peace, the embodiment of love, the embodiment of expanded awareness, we're just talking about this beloved presence. But the more we allow it to have dominion in our lives, our relationships become effortless because we're not the doer. They just unfold as we accept our rightful place in this evolutionary process of humanity, from Homo Neanderthal to Homo erectus to Homo sapien and now to Homo universalis, an evolving species awakening the heart of humanity to love one another, knowing that there really is no other. And so we come here to reflect that back to one another, to reflect back the beloved the beloved in me sees the beloved in you. And Barbara Marks Hubbard said, the greatest prayer that any of us could ever say is, we are one. And so as we close our service with that song, we are one, I am you, you are me, we are one, we are making a declaration that there's only one here, unveiling itself, not as lover and beloved anymore, but as love itself, a love that knows no other, a love that embraces the smallest of beings as its own self. And in that, we transform this world one heart at a time. So take a deep breath and give a sigh for the divine, ha, as you ground yourself in your body, knowing that all is well. And so it is.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, please visit www.cslhuntsville.org.